Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 203, Mother and Father Tantras.
So how is everyone? So we're in the middle of Tantra now. I think we did creation stage, and now we're going to begin to look at perfection stage. But I just want to start by going over where we're going in this marathon that we've been doing. So we looked at the Guhya Samaja Sadhana to give you just an idea of what it is. Of course, nobody's being initiated and nothing, but we're just so you know what's there is the point of the whole teaching on Tantra. And this is allowed to be done by His Holiness, even recommended to be done, because this is all otherwise very esoteric, but it's meant to be done by His wish. So people know what it is, because there are all these debased ideas of what Tantra is, you know, sex and violence and weird things people think is what it is, which it isn't at all. And so that's why we talk about it in this way. This is like about it rather than pretend. Some of you may have, in fact, be initiated or have your own teachers and do this kind of thing. I don't do that. But we're trying to let people know what it is and what it isn't. That's the whole point. And there are two documents that I put on the reading last minute. I apologize. And one of them is the perfection stage things, again, from the Essential Tibetan, some excerpts from Nagarjuna's perfection stage writing, which is in some people call it completion stage, I call it perfection stage, Dzogrim, of the Unexcelled Yoga Tantra. And then one is some segments from the first chapter of the Guhya Samaja, the Esoteric Community Tantra, which is a big project I've been working on for 5-6 years with lots of people. And this is sort of rough, still not fully edited version of some parts of the first section, which I'll come back, we'll talk about. But before that, that's what we're going to do today. In a way, a root of sectarianism in Tibetan Buddhism comes. You can always spot it in a group when anyone says that only our order has the final keys to enlightenment. So some people do teach the Dzogchen saying, oh, nobody has that but us, the Nyingmas. And some people do teach the Unexcelled Yoga Tantra of the Kagyus and the Gelugs and the Sakyas, and they say nobody has these high things except us, you know. So whenever anybody does that, that's kind of an unfortunate thing. And it's much best to realize that everybody has the full path from A to Z, you know, in Tibet, really. And therefore, even the word sect is not appropriate in the case of Tibetan Buddhism. If you look up the definition of sect in English dictionary, in religious studies sort of lingo, it means, its basic meaning is a division within a religious tradition where people on the two sides of the division feel that the other one on the other side is no longer a member of the same religion. For example, the Protestants and the Catholics in the initial Reformation, you know, where they were condemning each other to the Rome is Babylon, you know, and it's everybody in Rome under Rome is going to hell type of thing. And then the Romans saying, oh, those who no longer follow the Pope and who are following Luther and not having the Latin Mass, you know, they are like no longer proper Christians, like Mel Gibson and his father, for example. They have this cult within Catholicism where they feel that the vulgar languages, you know, like English, doing the Mass in English or in French or German or something like that is heresy. So that's a sect. And none of the Tibetan orders, as I prefer to call them, Nyingma, Sakya, Kagyu, Gelug, Shijie, There's a bunch of others. Those are the four main ones. None of them feel that the others are of a different religion. Absolutely not. So it's more subtle, their division, divisiveness. Some of the Tibetan teachers themselves are divisive. But the root of it that you can always spot when you're looking among orders, you know, which Tibet House does not belong to any particular order. We have teachers from all the orders. We have spiritual advisors from all the orders. And also the non-Buddhist Buddhists, right? The Tibetan Buddhists who are not Buddhist, but they are Buddhist. The Bumbos, that's the Bumbos, you know, what they call Bön, B-O-N, right? In Tibet, they're not considered Buddhist. The Buddhists in Tibet consider the Bumbo a different religion, and the Bön people in Tibet consider the Buddhists a different religion. But outside of Tibet, the Dalai Lama considers them just another group of Buddhists. And he's really right that he was decades ahead of me on that one. I was following the more traditional Tibetan pattern about it, although I had friends amongst the Bön personally, but I thought, well, they say they don't follow Shakyamuni Buddha. But then actually I discovered that they have a Buddha that's from Persia, you know, at some time long in the past before you have written history, so we don't know. And they want to become Buddhas, enlightened. And they have bodhisattvas, and they have monks, and they have nuns, and they have all the same set of texts, actually. But supposedly all coming from Persia. And then when the Buddhist circumambulates a temple, they go around clockwise, meaning leaving the object that you circumambulate, the stupa or the temple, to your right hand, and they go counterclockwise, etc. But you can't say they're not Buddhists, because they want to become Buddhas. So they are Buddhists, actually, which is really a compliment to Tibetan culture. Tibetan, you know, Tibet is so Buddhist that the non-Buddhists are Buddhists. Really? That's great fun. There's a wonderful book, if people are interested in that, by a school teacher, someone who subsequently became a school teacher in Amdo, within the Chinese system, which he wrote in Chinese originally, by his name is Nulo Naksang, N-U-L-O Naksang, and it's called My Tibetan Childhood or My Tibetan Boyhood, I can't remember. I think My Tibetan Childhood. And based on the fact that he was writing it as a child, about his childhood, sort of, it was even published in Chinese in China. They didn't realize he was cataloging all the atrocities that occurred, you know, because they thought he was doing sort of culture or something. He was their own school teacher, their own system, high school teacher or something. It's a really moving and very, of course, dreadful book. Hello, how are you, Jeff? Nice to see you. And this is, there are 17 chapters in the esoteric community tantra. And it's main, what they call, among unexcelled yoga tantras, it's the main father tantra. And there's, among unexcelled yoga, there's two kinds in Tsongkhapa's interpretation. Some other Tibetan masters have other views. But he says they're either father or mother. There's no non-dual tantra as a special category, because both father tantras and mother tantras are both non-dual. And non-dual means that both cultivate compassion and wisdom at the same time, which in tantric context, compassion is symbolized by the vajra, you know, the little scepter thing that they hold, but vajra really means the clear light of the void. It's sort of the fundamental energy of the void, you know, of the void relativity, which we'll talk about more. That's what we're going to talk about today. And then wisdom is symbolized by the bell, you know. So tantra, vajra and bell are two implements that any tantric practitioner always has to have with them. And often people have them on rosaries, where they have this one. Someone gave me, and they only have a bell on it. I guess they were like wisdom. They figured maybe I'm compassionate enough, but I'm too stupid. So they put the bell on it. Usually you have a vajra and bell on two sides of a rosary. But so those two are normally there. And Father Tantra is one, and the vajra scepter at the highest level in perfection stage tantra stands also for what's called the magic body, which is like Maya Deha, which some people rudely call illusion body, which is not wrong. But Maya, in a non-dual sense, I think it's, you know, magicians do have illusions, but of course the whole world is like a magical illusion of the world of suffering, of samsara, is a magical illusion, and the magic maker there is ignorance. But then the Buddha world, the world of the mandala in Tantra, or the Buddhaverse in the Pure Land type of school that we've looked at in earlier classes in this long class, long course, that's a world where the magic is made by compassion instead of ignorance, you know, wisdom and compassion. And the world is made of wisdoms. Remember, we've talked about that as the basic definition of Tantra. It's the rebuilding of an enlightened world wherein beings are optimally nurtured to come to their own enlightenment and freedom from suffering.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part episode was originally recorded during the ongoing Force for Good class series, originally held in New York City at Tibet House US, November 2016. The Force for Good class series is inspired by the works of the Dalai Lama and Daniel Goleman's book Force for Good by the same title. To learn more about this ongoing in-person and online class series, please visit tibethouse.us and visit the Tibet House US YouTube channel. In the first half of this week's episode, we got an introduction to the Tantras, Vajrayana, and Tibetan Buddhism. If you're inspired to learn more about Tantra, the Buddhist inner sciences, or any of the advanced practices mentioned in this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Bob Thurman Podcast and look for episodes also titled Buddhist Inner Sciences and Buddhism 101. These podcast series focus on interrelated teachings that will help further anyone's understanding of these wonderful life-transforming and mind-altering practices. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part by the generous support of the Tibet House membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including invites to special events, including Dosset tours around the world with Robert Thurman and friends, led by geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Your monthly support helps make these podcasts possible, as does your subscription. So if you haven't subscribed in your favorite podcasting platform, do us a favor and subscribe to the Bob Thurman Podcast. Every like, comment, share, and subscription helps support this podcast, as does your monthly support as a Tibet House member. To learn more about subscribing to this podcast, visit the podcast description below. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by Tenzin Chogyal, used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode, which includes a reading of poetry by Gary Gock.
To become a Buddha, you want to be able to manifest whatever people need. Different kinds of beings need different things. to open a doorway for them to their own seeing reality, which makes it then, when they see that, then they know they have the possibility of becoming free from suffering and enlightened themselves. They know that. And so then a Buddha being, Buddha beings, all the many infinite numbers of Buddha beings, they manifest, as they put it in their own Gangla Gangdul Dela Detamba, they manifest to whomsoever, whatever educates that person. And so magic body is sort of the vehicle, tantric vehicle of accelerating the evolutionary development to where one has the mastery of energy at the level of light to be able to create an embodiment. And it's not necessarily always a person. It could be an animal, if it's in the animal realm, it could be a building, it could be a planet, according to this really extravagant view of the creativity of compassion, of the power of love and compassion, of a being who is, as I always say, never omnipotent. Never omnipotence is never claimed by any Buddha or by Buddhists about any Buddha, but a kind of omnicompetence is claimed in dealing with the difficult situation of beings' ignorance and their therefore causing themselves and others suffering. So that's the magic body is cultivating. That's the shortcut of many, many thousands of lifetimes in a single life, or 7 lives or 16 lives, in the sort of magical, transformative, laboratory of the Tantra, which is the mandala universe. Magic body is cultivating that side. And then the other side is clear light itself, which is the fundamental reality of the universe as being emptiness, which being empty of itself is this infinite sort of bed of substance or bed or trans substance of infinite energy, which is utterly quiescent on its own because it has no motive to do anything because everything is already done because it's infinite. And I've repeated this slogan many times to you, so you're familiar with it now, but therefore can be drawn on infinitely. It's infinitely nurturing in the way that the Buddhists understand the universe. And yet it is all of the things in the universe. And so this non-dual vision of it is what they call the clear light of the void, you know. And it's not a dark, empty, you know, they have a big thing. Never think of emptiness as a dark space of nihility. Always think of emptiness as the pure potentiality of everything in the universe to be transformed in whatever is good out of whatever is bad, whatever seems bad. And based on Buddha's realization, as we've talked about from the very beginning, from the Theravada individual vehicle Buddhism, the Buddha's discovery that the universe is this fundamental, infinite, beneficent energy, not a personal energy, just presence of infinite energy. Which is the clear light of the void, it's said to be, right? Clear light of freedom, you could call the void freedom too. Clear light of freedom. Transparency, and again, clear light is not a bright light, it's a grayish transparency, like what a diamond is like. If light is shined on it, it's brilliant. If it's in the dark, it's just, you can see through it. Right, that's transparency, okay? So that's this one. Therefore, the Guhya Samaja is the most important of the father tantras, the most important of the mother tantras, which therefore more emphasizes this kind of process of plunging even that illusory, dreamlike, magical body into the emptiness again and again, sort of rehearsing the death rebirth, the death recreation process endlessly, yogically, without actually dying out of the coarse body, but going through the psychological, psychic experience of giving up and giving away one's life again and again, and then recovering it through developing the aesthetic of the mandala and the magic body. But the emphasis there is on the technique, like the genetic engineering, the internal neuroscientific and almost genetic engineering of energizing this kind of body. So therefore, these Buddha, these deity beings that you see with multiple arms, some of them, you know, multiple faces, like the Yamantaka over there. There's a couple of Yamantakas back there that I really like. The thousand arm Devalokiteshvara. Those are like genetic templates of developing a body that could manifest whatever it takes to help whoever it is simultaneously many, many emanations. And so this is supposed to be the best tantra for doing that. And then, but that's a process of plunging again and again into clear light. And so Mother Tantra emphasizes the experience of going in and out of the clear light. And in the perfection stages, the second half of the third stage, the way it's usually counted, so like they want to make it five stages, but actually it can blow up into more than five. But they want to make it five stages. And the third stage is the first one where the energies all go into the central channel, and the death experience and the rebirth and the between state and the rebirth experience is fully, consciously, lucidly undergone by the yogi or yogini. And the second half of that, that's in the first half of it, and then the second half of it is where then the magic body is developed, where you rise out of the clear light instead of going sort of back right away into your coarse body, which is left in a kind of trance. You know, what they call cataleptic trance in these advanced yogas. And instead you go up in like a meditational conscious dream, lucid dreaming-like state in the magic body, and in which you can go actually on subtle body plane to other universes and so forth. You can do all sorts of things, and you can again give away that body, and you can again do this many, many times because it's all on the level of subtle body sort of thing. And it's not meat space. So you don't have to deal with the messiness of like getting a new meat body, you know, basically. By the way, who here has seen Doctor Strange? It's an assigned homework for the next class on the 7th. Seriously. I know I'm particularly childish and I love, you know, dramatized comic books, although they're really like Batman and Superman smash bash are kind of tiresome. But this one is really interesting. It's really fun, actually. Even though the Chinese in Hollywood forced the producers, in order to show it in China, to move Dr. Strange's guru from the ancient one who was in Tibet to a nice British lady in Batman 2. But anyway, never mind. It's really great, the special effects, and really you're going to like it. And you see it as tantric. That's a magic body. He goes in and out of magic body, basically. I mean, they don't even know that, and they're not trying to do that, but they just have it, like, they call it astral body and so on, which is fine. But it's very interesting. Like, the Matrix is like that, too. It also subliminally teaches, in an aesthetic way, of identifying with a hero in a drama, you know, like, it teaches people about the idea of sort of living in a virtual reality, something like that. So the mandala practice at this high advanced level is like that, and it's marvelous. So I'm assigning it, okay, as a field trip. We should all go together, really, but none of us have time, you know. Anyway, so in the fourth stage is called the clear light stage. So the second half of the third stage is magic body stage. Fourth stage is clear light stage, and fifth stage, which is really almost Buddhahood and Buddhahood, I call it the communion stage. Some people just call it the union stage. I used to call it the integration stage. I think in that segment that I have from my older book at Central Tibetan Buddhism, I was calling it integration. But I don't like integration, and that's not wrong, and union is not wrong. But I like communion because yuganada, which is the Sanskrit word, or sungjuk in Tibetan, means the union of a pair. So it really has the non-duality sort of cognitive dissonance thing, of this total union, and yet the individuals of the pair also preserve their individual awareness of that total union. So they're both completely one, but they're aware of each one giving over themselves to the other one, type of thing. So that's the nature of the clear light and the magic body, is that they are one, but they're also individually there. It's like in an exoteric text, one of the first texts that we did in our series that we're doing here, trying to translate the entire scientific literature of Buddhism, which, thank you very much, on my getting my PhD in 1972, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and my old Mongolian teacher, wonderful, kindly, both of them, ganged up on me one day, and they said, oh, don't just work for those professors in that university, now you have your PhD, you need to translate the whole tenure. I said, oh, thanks, that's only 4,000 books. And I said, oh, not in this lifetime, you silly. You just set it up and get it going. And then, you know, for other lifetimes, you'll do it. And the Dalai Lama remembered that. And he told uh, He told the president of Colombia, actually, at a luncheon, private luncheon, he said, Lee, Professor Thurman needs at least three lifetimes to finish his project. And so Bollinger very gamely said, oh, that's wonderful, Your Holiness, but, you know, we have a problem because we don't have that system here. And then I thought, but was too shy to say, in those days, you mean I can't reincarnate in my professorship? What's the matter? And they said, they would have said, no, definitely not. Anyway, never mind. So this is a book in that series, though, this particular one. So this is three books, actually, all together, because one thing the Dalai Lama said when we were, there's another great project of translating the sutras, which are the religious scriptural texts, more religious scriptural texts, which are only about 1,000 or 1,200 of them in the Tibetan canon. They're all originally from Sanskrit, from India. They're the remains of the great library of Alexandria of India, namely the Nalanda Library. And there's one Lama from Bhutan, and Tibetan Lama from Bhutan. He has a plan called 84,000, very nice, based in Singapore, to translate those scriptures. I gave him a copy, an electronic copy of my Vimalakirti, and we tweaked it a little, and he's publishing that electronically. And there were already three pirated versions floating around anyway on the electronic. And when we founded that thing together at a conference he organized, we all went to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and then they asked some of the Tibetan Lamas at the time, said they didn't want any tantras to be translated or published at all. And Dalai Lama said, no, you can publish them. He said, but don't publish any root tantra without first having the commentary ready so people don't misunderstand the sometimes shocking language in the root tantra and think it's meant to be taken literally. And that's very important. He made that stricture. So this is the three things. So first is the esoteric community, the great king of mind creations, secrecy of the all Tathagata body, speech, mind. And this is my innovation here that my colleagues are still a little unsure of, but I think they're going along with me. You know, we have the expression in English, all-star, the all-star team, the all-star game. So this expression of the body, speech, and mind of all Tathagatas, which is the name of Buddha, right, the transcendent Buddha, it constantly occurs in the text all the time. It's so laborious with the of the and everything. So I got the idea of saying the all Tathagata this and the all, like the all-star, you know, and it works actually great, and it's much more economical. And that's what it is in Sanskrit. It's just Sarva Tathagata in a compound without a lot of prepositions, you know, to make it like awkward to read. So once people get used to it, they don't mind. Then also body, speech, mind, I put with dashes instead of body, speech, and mind, because one of the great secrets of the esoteric community is that at this level, body, speech, and mind are one thing. They're not different. You know, mind is body, mind is speech, and body is speech. And actually, of all of them, speech is the driver. Speech is what shapes, the word, you know, is what shapes physical reality and mental reality, actually. And which is very Sanskritic, you know, very Indic. But it's also Buddha's view, you know. And it's kind of like a secret thing. So I always put body, speech, mind in a dash when it's in that context. And by great Vajradhara Buddha, also when people translate tantras, the few that have been translated in English, they never put it like there's an author. Because, of course, they don't believe that Buddha taught that. They think some weird guy made it up 1,000 years later and pretended Buddha taught it in a vision or something. But actually, in the Tibetan and the Indian Mahayana and Mongolian version and esoteric Japanese and Chinese and Korean, they think Buddha taught it, actually. And I have some arguments to show that I think he did, too. But it's on a level where, of course, in a way, you can't prove it. You know, you can't go in. There's nobody videoed it. It wasn't live streamed in a lasting way. And it was live streamed, actually. Buddha has such ability, but it wasn't recorded. Anyway, except in this text way and in the practice of people. Now, it goes together with a very important commentary written by Master Chandrakirti, who lived in the 7th century, but who received the teaching, he says, from Nagarjuna, who started living in the 1st century, and who is said to have lived 600 years in the tradition, again, which the Western people, modern people don't believe, but the Tibetans do, we do, and I do. Definitely. And he didn't eat food for the last 500 years, so he could last. You know, caloric restriction is the way to be long-lived, you know. And he didn't eat any food. He was an alchemist and a doctor in his youth, and he had some kind of little special elixir pill made of stone or something that he took, but he didn't eat ordinary food. And then they're still there. Nagarjuna is still there. A really energetic practitioner can meet him now in his Obi-Wan Kenobi astral body. Don't worry. Anyway, he wrote this wonderful book, Chandrakirti did, called The Illuminating Lamp, Pradipodhyotana, an extensive six-parameter explanation of the glorious esoteric community tantra. That's the second level of commentary. And then third level of commentary is the Tsongkhapa, who in the 700 years later, he wrote an annotational commentary of the Illuminating Lamp, which is like, therefore, interlinear space, which he considered such an important thing, Tsongkhapa, because this was his greatest. These are just things from the beginning of our series that we don't need to look at. But he wrote that because he felt it was so, so important. And then the first xylographic books, you know, that were carved in wood in mirror reverse and then used for printing, the Tibetans only started doing that in the early 15th century. And like Martin Luther and the Gutenberg Bible, Gutenberg Press, this may also very much account. We have a graduate student who's a Tibetan, actually a brilliant young Tibetan, who is doing a dissertation now at Columbia on the role of texts and the printing of texts in the diffusion of Tsongkhapa's school from the early, which became the school of the Dalai Lama, led by the Dalai Lamas after Tsongkhapa's death in 1419 in the Tibetan, what I call the Ganden Renaissance. Anyway, so this is the text. Okay, so the first chapter of the Great Samaja, and I showed you in another class, I think the mandala itself, the Great Samaja mandala, and I didn't cue that up here for this one. But so it's the way it works is like this. So it begins, they always begins with the commentary before the root verse, quite a long way to get to the first verse of the Guhya Samaja, which we will try to get to tonight because it's such a shocking thing. You're all going to be really shocked. I think it's great fun. But so it begins with the Pradipodhyo. Oh, good. I hadn't opened it. That's great. Great. I should have checked it. My elbow thing. That's okay. That's okay. It's not champagne. It's not champagne. Okay. Over here. And, in the language of India, Pradipodhyotana Namatika. And they always repeat the Sanskrit name because they think it's very auspicious to hear the Deva Bhasha, the language of the gods. Right? We talked about that. Did I tell you the story about my Sanskrit teacher at Harvard? Well, after first semester of Sanskrit, which I only took as a graduate student, sadly. I didn't discover it as an undergraduate. After coming back from 6 years of being a pseudo-monk, there was an extra credit question after the test, you know, the final exam. And it was, translate into Sanskrit from English, the sentence, the several sentences. And it says, in heaven, the gods speak Sanskrit. Those who do not know that language are not admitted there. he wasn't a Hindu, I think. He was a Daniel H.H. Ingalls. We called him His Holiness. But he was a great Sanskritist, actually. But he was a little bit of a snob. Anyway, in the Tibetan language, Dharma Sarvajepa, that's all. And in English, the illuminating lamp. Actually, I should put that. That would be adding, but not a translation. But I should put that. Okay, now the first verses, therefore, are Tsongkhapa's verses in the 14th century. And there's a lot to comment on in the verses. You know, can you read them? Can you see them? I hope so. I bow my head devoted to the primal savior's lotus feet. Primal savior means Buddha. And this is the omnicompetent vision of the Buddha. I should probably really capitalize those two words. I won't start editing it. I can't help myself, but I won't. Primal means always was there. And savior is, some people up until now would translate it as protector, but it isn't really just an ordinary protector. There are protectors, which are like sort of fierce archangels that Buddhists have in India and Tibet and Mongolia and China and Japan and so on. And, you know, what they call nyo-o in Japanese, you know, like fierce kings. And that's a protector. But the one, the nata in Sanskrit, is one who becomes a shelter, a refuge for the soul, you know, for the long-term evolutionary continuum of consciousness. And so it really does fit what Western Abrahamic religions or Indian theistic religions think of as a savior. It really does fit like that, even though he says, well, I save you by teaching, you have to really save yourself by understanding. But still, that's still as much a saving as anybody can do to someone else, according to the Buddha. So I think it's a proper word. My colleagues freak out about this. They say, oh, you can't use that word. That's a Christian word. I say, I don't think anybody owns words. You know, if you look at any Oxford English Dictionary, there are different levels of all kinds of words, you know. And there was this meaning in this context and this meaning in that century and this meaning in that institution and this meaning. And they all have different meanings, you know. So 50 years from now, there will be the Buddhist meaning of these things. And there'll be a learned article on it by my next life. I will write it. The mentor who united, mentor, that's my translation for guru, because I don't like master. Teacher is okay, but then there's sort of different levels of teacher. Mentor, it's nice, it's a level of teacher, because mentor means like one who not only teaches the subject, but models the attainment of the understanding of the subject, is the idea. That's the mentor, that's a mentor. Should be, which teachers really should be. You know, teachers shouldn't just be like blabbing, although it's even useful to blab something that they don't fully understand themselves. It's still useful, you know, like I do, and I don't fully understand these things. But they should be trying to live up to it, that's all. So the mentor who united with the supreme science, and vidya means the feminine Buddha, female Buddha, which they call vidya, which means science. But of course, no modern translations will translate it like that. They'll translate it spell or something, vidya. They'll translate, figure out some other, or they'll use the Sanskrit word and think they translated something. But they won't use science. And I remember one, in an earlier version of another text, one even Tibetan guy who I was working with, he said, no, we can't say science. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, these people wear like robes, or, you know, the male ones, they wear like loincloths and they look like sadhus and things like that. And science people, scientists, they wear white coats and they have lab things like doctors, a little mirror that doctors used to wear on their heads. So that can't be a scientist, a vidyadhara, a holder of science, you know, holder of knowledge. Can't be a scientist, because they don't dress like scientists. I said, well, there are different kinds of scientists, you know. You have hippie scientists in ancient India. Anyway, the supreme, and this is female science, this one. She's herself is the science. Anyway, to show this art of great bliss to attain the supreme success. Now, this is especially the art of great bliss. And art I'm translating here in the sort of, you know, in context of arts and sciences, right? You know, medicine is an art, you know. In arts and sciences, there's medical science, but there's the art of, you know, clinical, that's art. And then there's engineering as an art, and there's a lot of arts that are not just painting or doing, like, you know, the art school of art. And when you have arts and sciences, all of the actual activity things that are done are arts, you know. So it's sort of a broad, it almost means like method. It's a broader meaning of art. But I like that because it's because it is an art. You know? So the art of great bliss. And what is the art of great bliss? Now, remember I said in my introduction to perfection stage that the different levels of it, the magic body level is starting in the third perfection stage, the first time where the yogi takes the energies, circulatory energies, and breath energies, what they call wind energies, but that's in the nervous system and everything, with, like electrical almost, as well as respiratory, and takes the more subtle ones are, and takes those energies and puts them all into the center of the nervous system, and thereby undergoes consciously a lucid dying process of giving away their sense of possession of their embodiment, right? But what is the consciousness that does it? This is the distinguishing characteristic of the unexcelled yoga. is that the consciousness that does that is bliss consciousness. How do you experience the surrender to vast infinite energy plane of the void? How do you do that? There is a threshold experience that almost seems like you're becoming nothing, because when you go unconscious on the way, and how do you surrender to do, learn to surrender to do that? Letting go of everything, what is it? It's actually a bliss. What are the experiences in life that are close to it or suggest it? Orgasm, for example. The giving up of sort of control of oneself and letting one's body become a vessel of a flow of energy, right? And although that's considered, but that's why you have the erotic, there are probably some here, male-female union images, the Eros type of images, and then they have the Thanatos, the death type of images, all subconscious level of energy. And so the art of great bliss involves, it is the great bliss is the subjectivity that can navigate at these levels of subtle consciousness. Remember, we already talked a few classes ago, and I don't know, some of you may have been online, some of you weren't here, so I'm sorry to refer to these past things, but you know what? You didn't show up. But we went in the study of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, those charts about the 8 dissolution processes that it talks in Tibetan Book of the Dead. But those processes are put there by people who were this kind of yogi, who consciously, contemplatively went through that kind of withdrawing their from their coarse senses and giving up sort of the sense of possession of the, you know, one face, two eyes, two ears, nostrils, tongue, head, skin, you know, hands, legs, body, and let go of it. And then, you know, arise visionarily, only imaginatively at first in the creation stage, right, which we talked about. But then at this stage, they're actually doing that, where they go into cataleptic trance, normal respiration ceases, they sit in what's called clear light or sit in that kind of trance, almost like a hibernating being, and air does go in and out, so they don't drop dead, but they're not normally involved even in drawing breath. It's a very advanced thing. They claim that they do, and actually there are documented cases of people sort of outside hovering around on them and observing this. But of course, Westerners just say, oh, it must all be fakes. They're probably looking for a handout or to make some money. They'll always dismiss it without actually looking at it. Until recently, a few people, Dalai Lama has his neuroscience SWAT team, and they already, Herbert Benson went over there and noticed these people who could make their body rise to 110 degrees Fahrenheit and melt ice sheets and things like that. They already did that, but that's a minor thing compared to this type of thing. And then there are those who die and they sit without breathing and their consciousness is sort of not in the body, but the body is held in the clear light, stasis, you could say, in the cataleptic trance for sometimes 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And they have some sort of portable fMRI machine in Mumbai, and then they're coming from Germany and Switzerland, these people in the Mind and Life group, and when they hear that so-and-so has died, who is an exceptionally well-attained Lama and somewhere in South India, and they're heading for that. And Dalai Lama like muses and he looks worried. He says, I'm afraid they won't get there in time. Some of them can't stay that long. But I guess I can't ask them to pre-schedule. He says that. And, I don't know if they've ever done it, but they'll get there. Anyway, so the art of great bliss means how on the event horizon of completely melting into the void, so to speak, experience like that, on the event horizon, how to shape and remain conscious of that. And remember the 8 stages. And I'm sorry I don't have a slide of it today, but you saw it before. You know, you get out of the coarse body by, remember, earth to water, inner sign is mirage or hallucination, water to fire, inner sign is smoky, it's a space filled with sort of billowing smoke, fire to wind, there's inner sign, not with your eyes, you've already left your eyes more or less, and you're seeing, or your ability, the earth to water leaves solid things, sense of solidity, and your body's going to sleep. So then fire to wind is the sign is a firefly swarm, or more secondarily, sparks flying, shower of sparks, or more tertiarily, moiré pattern of raindrops on a still pond surface, mutually intersecting like that, a kind of like thing like that. And then that's the third one, and then the fourth one is wind into space consciousness, you either space or consciousness, or actually space consciousness, like open space consciousness, which is then a consciousness that is subtle, that doesn't, it's not quite subtle, it's on the fringe of subtle, remember, which has no content because you already dropped out of your core senses. So you know, it's like when your leg goes to sleep, right, when you sit in an uncomfortable posture, here your whole body has gone to sleep. It's that part of the death experience. And you're in just space consciousness, so you're in your inner sign. And you're not noticing, like, even breathing or anything in your body. Your body is still taking air because this is meditation. I mean, when you die, it isn't. But when you do it meditatively, the body is open to oxygen, but you're not sucking it in, so to speak. And you've gone past that autonomic nervous reflex, nervous system reflex. And then you reach, that's the end of the coarse embodiment and the coarse mind connected to the coarse embodiment. That's the end of meat space, remember? We went through this. Then you go from there to the luminance state, where that open space becomes like pure white moonlight. There's no moon in it, but it's just light space suffused with moonlight. And there are these 40 instincts, I think, connected with desire, I believe. I always forget. You're shaking your head. Did you look it up, the number?
33.
Oh, 33, the first one. Okay, thank you. Finally, I keep forgetting that. I keep forgetting to look it up. 33 states connected with desire, I believe, and the white space. And then there are different, they're like instincts, basically, instinctual surges. But when one is a great yogi and has already done this, one sort of ignores those and just feels that blank space of moonlit space. And then one moves from there into the sunlit space, which I call radiance. So luminance, radiance, where you have 40 instincts connected with hostility, I think. And aggression, you know, so that's your eros and your thanatos that Freud discovered in the unconscious, again, at the instinctual level. And again, the normal person who's never trained at all in that is all feeling just all these whipped around by these surges, even in an inner space, you know, although they're out of their ordinary meat space body, but they're mentally like projecting all kind of embodiments in reacting to these inner surges like hostility, fear, aggression, you know, escaping, you know, whatever, a mixture of physical postures and mental surges. And then finally, from a sunlit space, and that's a radiant, reddish-orange sunlit space, and then one goes from that to the third level of the subtle mind, because one's whole consciousness is inside the central nervous system, still in connection to the body, but inside the central nervous system. The third one is a dark-lit space where one loses consciousness, and there's seven instinctual surges there having to do with sleep and lethargy and, you know, feeling tired and all this kind of thing, and sort of consciousness closing down. And there is really an experience as if it were an experience of nothingness, where one feels one's at the verge of nothingness, and there's fear associated with that. But when one really gets into the dark-lit space, called immanence, I call it immanence, because it's a threshold thing only. And I think that's where every night when you sleep, when you go into that dark thing, you lose consciousness, you're really at that state, actually, internally. You've given up thinking about your body if you luckily have gone to deep sleep. And you go to deep sleep and you think that that deep sleep is a dark state of sort of a rehearsal of the nothingness that a materialist thinks they're going to experience at death. But these folks would disagree from their voyaging into these areas. And then you come to the super subtle body mind, where you then go through that immanent state into the clear light state, which is a grayish transparency state where there's no difference between light and dark, which embraces both darkness and light in some inconceivability. And it's all very inconceivable and inexpressible. And actually, matter and energy are not opposite. I mean, energy and mind are not opposite. Matter and mind are not opposite. They're one thing at that state, at that super subtle state. And that's the moment of death, actually. And the only way to reach that, and even the only way to go down through those three subtle body-mind things in the central nervous system, is bliss. The bliss of that release is the only way to overcome the fear and the wish to recoil into a separated, you know, self-controlling, self-isolating, self-defending, you know, self, you know, perimetered body.
If you are not yet aware, poet, translator, painter, publisher Lawrence Ferlinghetti is the first poet read by millions in his own lifetime. He's also the founder of the first bookstore in America dedicated to paperbacks, City Lights, which pioneered the homey library atmosphere now used by chain book outlets. City Lights Publishing Company was a major vehicle for the Beats, made famous during the obscenity trial over a book by Allen Ginsberg, and continues to remain a contemporary, vital publishing house in America. A biography of Ferlinghetti is available by fellow poet Neely Cherkovsky. Millennium Cities. How fragile the flesh. How fragile the world around it, this life on earth evanescent, deep in samsara. How transient these solid, ephemeral buildings, concrete bastions, piled up brick and mortar, wooden caravanseries built on sand, crystal cities alight, spectral skyscrapers, sheathed in glass, vaulted in night. Houses of cards in sleeping suburbias, barrios of shacks made of mud and chewing gum. Fiberglass cars and transient trains, prairie schooners into Pullmans, sheeted in oblivion, transient their tracks and stations, their salle de pas perdu, halls of lost footsteps. How fragile the bodies pulsing in them, each temporary shell housing a life. Ballroom dancers, husband and wife, statuesque secretaries, blondes in porno videos, heavies in heroic operas, bodhisattvas bathing in Ganges. How fragile this frieze of mummers, this dumb show, insubstantial pageant, gone in a breath, pale idols in the night streets, dance and bound to death. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.